everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, welcoming you back to another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast, where this time I catch up with fellow yacht racing journalist Andy Rice. As well as being a regular contributor to all of the major sailing publications, Andy is host of the Sail Juice Podcast and also runs the Road to Gold 12-step training program aimed at improving your racing performance.
Hi, we're getting to the end of 2022. It's been a super busy season for me, Andy Rice, and also for Justin Chisholm of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Justin, it feels like life's almost back to normal. It's so long ago. It's not that long ago, but it just feels like COVID is sort of disappearing in the rearview mirror now.
Yeah, it does. Thankfully, it's there was a time when we were all locked in that I thought professional yacht racing was done and we're going to have to find another something to write about. But fortunately, it all seems to have come back. I'm busy and I know you're busy too. So why don't we start with you, Andy? What have you been up to? I seem to have seen a lot of your content flowing out from the events that you've been attending.
The work really came back this year after an 18-month lean period, and it sort of started coming back with the Olympics in Tokyo in August 2021, and it kept on going with last year's Rolex Fastnet race, and then it's rolled on through this season. And from not ever having seen a kite go in the air off a beach until last December, I somehow have found myself at the centre of the kite foil racing world, which is... Wow. The new Olympic discipline, and I've probably been doing more of that than anything else this season. But yeah, I've just come off the back of an 8-week tour of Europe that I saw big boat events like the Barcolana in Trieste and the Bosphorus Cup, which takes you down the middle of Istanbul, both spectacular events for maxis and boats of that ilk. And then at the other end of the spectrum, wing foil racing on 60-liter boards that barely float when you stand on them, sort of blatting around Lake Garda at 30 knots on this tiny hoverboard, or the kite foil racing, which is just the most spectacular thing, and I guess is still seen as controversial amongst some circles as to whether it's a form of sailing or not. But it's powered by the wind, and once they are up and foiling, which takes about 5 knots of wind, they can be doing 30 knots of speed through the water with just 5 or 6 knots of wind powering them along. So probably the most efficient machines there are in the whole wind-powered world.
You talked a little bit about it there. There's been some resistance to accepting these kite-driven classes as proper sailing, you know, the traditionalists. And I guess I was kind of including myself in that. I love the idea of it. I love the idea of kite surfing. Never done it. Would love to do it. Probably passed me by now, I think. But you've been watching it closely. Is it proper racing?
Yes, it is proper racing. But of course, as boats get faster, then every maneuver becomes more expensive, just as we already know this with skiffs and catamarans like the 49er and the Nacra, two of the other Olympic classes. I think one of the surprising things about the F50s being used in SailGP, I think when they first came out for the 2017 America's Cup in Bermuda, we thought tack loss was going to be a massive problem for those boats. Actually, as it's turned out, it's not too bad. And the same with the AC75s, the maneuver loss is not too bad. But you can't get away from the fact that going in a straight line is much faster than turning a corner, and so there's not a lot of corner turning in the kite foil racing. So every corner, every maneuver you make, you've got to make it count. But what's really exciting about it is that the harder you push, the harder you go, but the closer you come to wiping out or crashing. So nothing is ever done. You know, there are no safe wins. There are no easy victories in wing foil racing, and also they have experimented with their finals format to where they have reached the perfect compromise, in my view, from a media perspective, of rewarding the worthy winner with the gold medal whilst leaving the door open sufficiently for anyone in the top 10, if they have an amazing final day, to still be able to win the series. And the great thing from our point of view is that whoever crosses the line of the finish line in first in the last race of the championship can do their backflip or can go 10 metres high in the sky like they celebrate on the wing foilers, on the kite foilers. And, you know, you haven't got that weird thing that we had in Tokyo last year. I remember when Matt Wern won the laser gold medal with the medal race to spare. Well, there was a day's gap. So let's say he won that last race of the qualifying on Wednesday, and the media in the media centre in Tokyo were running around saying, well, what do we do? You know, we haven't got a picture of a medal around his neck, but we've got to say he won the gold medal because he has. So there was a 48-hour delay until Matt Wern actually stood on the podium to receive his gold medal, which in media terms makes no sense at all. And I'm really disappointed that there hasn't been a progression from the traditional medal race, which I think only works about a third of the time.
So what's the difference then with the kite foiling format? Talk us through a typical regatta.
Yeah, so this is the stumbling block, is that I can't give you a pithy answer other than you have your week of qualifying, and first and second go through to the four board final as a matter of right. The other eight in the top 10, numbers third to 10th, get split into two semi-finals of four, and they battle it out in their semi-finals. Whoever wins each of those semi-finals becomes rider three and four. So now you've got your four finalists. But having won the qualifying series, the winner of qualifying is already on two match points. He or she needs three match points to win the championship. So if they win just one race, it's done and dusted. And that often happens. They have one race, and Daniela Moroz did this at the Worlds recently in Sardinia, goes out and does one really good race, done and dusted, Worlds done. But no one can argue with the fact that she was the best rider throughout the week anyway. Lauriane Nolot, who was in second, the French rider, she went through and won with one match point. She needed to win two races. She had her opportunity, but then she crashed near the Windward Mark and Daniela Moroz went past her, and that was the end of the championship. And then the other two go through with no match points. So they've got to win three races. So they've got to have an amazing day. But at the Youth Worlds for the kite foiling, which was in another venue in Sardinia earlier on in the year, we had a Polish rider, Nina Arcic, who came through in sixth at the beginning of the day and just sailed an absolute blinder of a series on the last day. And the Israelis, who were in first and second, just really had a fall from form that day. And so Nina Arcic came from not being anywhere close to the podium to winning the Youth World Championships, winning the gold medal. But in both scenarios, in the Daniela Moroz scenario, just won it from start to finish, or the Nina Arcic scenario, came from behind to have an amazing last day. I don't think anyone had any arguments about the right people winning the event. And from a media point of view, it's absolutely perfect.
I want to come back and ask you a bit more about the racing. But you've brought up an interesting point. So LGP this weekend, which was over in Dubai for the first time, Ben Ainslie's British team were the form team. Hardly put a foot wrong the whole event. I think all the results were in the top three. Got into the final, and we all know that the finals, you know, it's a new race, it's a new day. And we're even leading into the final turn. The final, you know, it came down to the final jibe to the turn mark to the finish, and they were ahead and they fluffed it, had a problem with the board. And Tom Slingsby, you know, made the jibe and took the event, having had a terrible event, really. I mean, he did well enough to qualify for the final, but on the Saturday, he couldn't get out of his own way. He was racing around at the back of the fleet. So I don't know what my point is, but I found it really, really exciting.
I think for that scenario, it works perfectly. I think that level of jeopardy loaded on the final race is fine, because each of those weekends works towards an overall series. So it's winning the season that matters. And so having that amount of jeopardy would be unfair on Ben Ainslie if that was the be all and end all of the competition. But it's only one leg of however many they've had in this season. I think they're having 14 next year or something.
As many as 14, yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of not dissimilar to Formula One and putting together a good season across a whole year. The scenario of winner takes all with those three in the final is very, very similar to what the IQ Foil windsurfers have. Now, they're the other new entrant into the Olympic scene. I'm not personally directly involved with them, but they have a very similar scenario where as long as you make it through to the final, you know that you've won a medal of some colour, and then it's just a matter of what colour are you going to win. And when it comes down to the Olympics and the culmination of 4 or 8 or 12 years of work, and it's all on one race, and there's been a Ben Ainslie level of domination throughout the week, and the yellow bib winner suffers some misfortune or something and doesn't end up winning the gold medal. I think I've got more questions about that, because there's so much of people's lives loaded into that one moment. And yeah. Maybe I would say this, wouldn't I, because I'm part of the kite foil scene, but I think the IQ foil has too much jeopardy, and the medal series, the medal race for the majority of, you know, all the floating boats, the 49ers and 470s, that just doesn't work for the reasons I've explained earlier. And for me, I feel that the kite foilers have got it just about right in the middle.
Yeah, I really like the carrying some points through idea. And maybe for CELGP that could work for the very final event, because I was in San Francisco last year and it was a bit of an anticlimax. The million-dollar race was kind of over really after the first couple of legs. Interesting stuff. Maybe that's the way to go. I want to just go back to the kite foiling, the kiting generally. What courses are these people racing around? And is it mixed sex, or is it separate fleets per gender?
Separate fleets. So I think it's okay to say boys and girls. So I know we have to say male and female normally, but I mean we're talking about young people. I talk about one of the German riders, Florian Gruber, as the granddaddy of the fleet, and he's age 28. So anyway, there are boys and girls, and a typical course would be a double windward leeward with a short reach to a jibe mark and then back again. It's sort of a 180 round a jibe mark and then back across the finish. If you've got multiple fleets running, then you can send the first fleet off on a square course off to one side, and they do their windward leeward over here and finish on a reach down here. Probably the most common is just a windward leeward. But the reaching one is, there's quite a lot of jeopardy in that, because that's when they're at their fastest and their biggest risk of crashing as well. And that's what makes it exciting, is that you never know when someone is going to go for a Burton. They are riding on the edge of control all the time. That's partly what makes it exciting, is you've sort of got your heart in your mouth the whole time.
Where have these kids come from? Because let's call them kids if they're as young as you say. This is a relatively new sport. It's new to the Olympics. Where have these guys come from?
Well, to give you an example, Daniela Moroz, who's now won her sixth world title from the USA, grown up kiteboarding in San Francisco. She is a kiteboarder through and through. And then Ellie Aldridge from Great Britain, she got the bronze medal. She was second in the world's last year show. So she's been a consistent performer over the last couple of seasons. She came from a conventional sailing background, sailed 29ers, and then did a couple of seasons in the 49er FX Olympic skiff, and then had a go at the kiting and has never looked back. And it tends to be one-way traffic. It won't always be this way, but once people have tried the kiting and they go that way, they don't tend to go back to where they've just come from. And they genuinely love what they do. It's got an amazing scene. It's the friendship within that scene is incredible, partly because I think it's cool, but it's also quite dangerous. You've got to look out for each other. You know, if you get things wrong, people can get injured. And yeah, it's though I think for some of those reasons, they're a very tight knit group of riders who come across really well when you interview them. They're super friendly to talk to, but they come from a variety of backgrounds, which I think is always the case when you've got a new discipline. And I saw that also at a wing foiling event that I reported at in Lake Garda. Ellie Aldridge for a holiday went straight to the wing foiling event just for a laugh. And she ended up second in that event to Paula Novotna, who is one of the, she's a multiple world champion in kiteboarding freestyle, doing the big wave stuff. So you're seeing people come from all sorts of backgrounds towards wing foiling as well. So anytime there's a new discipline, I think you have people coming in from multiple directions. And the sailors are hoping that their racecraft will be the thing that makes the difference. And the kiteboarders are hoping that their sort of muscle memory that they've gained from having kiteboarded since they were 6 or 8 or 10 years old is the thing that's going to work for them. And it will be interesting to see how that works out. But at the moment, I would say the kiteboarders, the ones that have that sort of depth of years in the sport, are the ones that are tending to win at the moment.
So, Andy, with such a young demographic in this fleet, do they all have huge Instagram followings? Is that part of the game?
They are certainly very avid Instagrammers, and that is their form of communication between a lot of them as well. I mean, I'm a bit of an old buffer in all that stuff.
This when I'm supposed to say no, you're not? But okay.
Well, if you know how to get into Instagram and you've seen me on there, that's because other people put me up there. It's not because I'm Instagramming. So apparently I feature quite a bit on Instagram, but that's other people doing the social media. But yes, I should really catch up, because that world is all over Instagram, and it's such a visual sport. It, you know, it's nearly always on a good looking beach, you know, it's such a beautiful scene to be around that it Instagrams extremely well. Yeah, so social media is a big part of that scene.
All right, moving on. You talked about the Barcelona earlier on. That's a race I've never attended, but it's on my list. Have you been there before, or is that your first time?
Yeah, I went there 3 years ago in 2019, and I was part of the commentary crew there with Alec Wilkinson on that occasion, and this time it was with Alec and with Shirley Robertson. So it's Rai TV, the Italian TV network. They do the Italian commentary. It's an absolutely huge event, the biggest event in Trieste every year. It's worth some crazy amount of money to the city, like 50 million euros or something. And you get sometimes up to 2,500 boats starting off one start line. And the race is only about 8 or 9 nautical miles long, but the start line is 1.5 nautical miles long. So you better choose the right end, and you better not be over the line early, because there's no going back.
Absolutely. I didn't realize it was that big. Wow. How many boats were there this time?
Well, it was a bit of a low entry at just over 1,600. So that's a bit of a disappointing entry for the Barcelona, but it is said to be the biggest yacht race there is, and that may well be true. I mean, it's beating the Round the Island race in the Isle of Wight for numbers. I can't think of anything else off starting off one start line that comes anywhere close to that.
Wow. And what size of boats are we talking? I know there's some big stuff. Does it? How small do they get?
Down to about 25 foot keel boats, and then the glamour end is 4 or 5 maxis duking it out, sort of in the 80 to 100 foot range. Normally there is almost no wind, or there is far too much wind. It's really unstable conditions at the top of the Adriatic. Trieste is sort of just on the border from the top end of Italy going into Slovenia. So it's just along the coast from Venice, and there's normally not much wind in the Adriatic up there. But when there is wind, there's far too much of it. But this year, we had a nice 15 to 20 knots. It was
wow,
absolutely spot on. And Wendy Schmidt, of sort of Google fame, and 11th Hour Racing, if you know 11th Hour Racing, it was her fairly new boat, launched late 2020, I think it was, Deep Blue. Had an amazing start. They were 15 feet shorter than the local heroes on Wild Thing, the Benussi brothers, who they're so famous that for the month before Trieste, all the buses are plastered with their faces down the side of these buses. You know, they are quite a big deal locally.
They're just local boat owners, or are they like pro sailors, or what's the story?
They're pro sailors. They've done pretty well, I think, in various things like Melges and stuff like that. They're good sailors, but they took on Scandia Wild Thing, Grant Warrington's old boat from nearly 20 years ago that was built for the Rolex Sydney Hobart race, and then it fell into disrepair. And then the Benussi brothers took it on a few years ago and have given it a second life. And this is where old Sydney Hobart boats come to die, really. You know, it's the sort of the elephant's graveyard. That's maybe not quite the right way of putting it, but they're not absolutely top end maxis, but they're still pretty decent boats, like the old Alfa Romeo of Neville Crichton's from 15 or 20 years ago. That was another one that's been renamed and repurposed. And then you had a few of the Ormuro di Venezia boats from 20 or 30 years ago. But it was Wendy Schmidt who became the first female skipper and first non-European to win this event as well. So quite a few firsts this year for Wendy Schmidt and her team of professionals.
That sounds amazing. How long does that race take then if it's 20 knots?
This year, the winner, Deep Blue, finished in just under an hour. So it's sort of round a square course, and there were lighter patches. It wasn't windy all the way around, but it was just a good moderate breeze, where normally it's a drift-a-thon like it was when Alec and I were trying to get something out of a three-hour race looking at 2,000 boats, most of which we didn't have a clue what their names were or who the people were on board. I mean, it's a commentator's nightmare when the wind speed is at that kind of level.
Absolutely. Well, I know a little bit what you mean. I wasn't commentating, but I went to the Bol d'Or on Lake Geneva this year. And again, it was a race I'd always wanted to go to, and there wasn't a breath of wind at the start. I don't mean it was light. I mean, there literally was not a breath. And the start line stretched from one side of the lake to the other and was completely full and three deep. And a guy with an easel could have painted the scene before the boats actually started to go. Right. It was hours. in any other country, people would have just said, that's it. You know, can't sail when there's no wind. We're going engine on. Let's go home and have a coffee or a beer or whatever. But no, they stuck at it. And they sailed all the way to the other end of the lake. I mean, the breeze did eventually come, but when it came, it was, you know, if it hit 10 knots, it would have been remarkable.
But then they have other years when it's the apocalypse. It's another one like the Barcolana, but even more so, I think, on Lake Geneva. It's generally nothing, but when it's not nothing, it's like 100 knots.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you also said you've been to the 470 Euros to me earlier before we started, and the Worlds. That's a class that interests me now, because that's now a mixed gender class. How's that working out for them?
Yeah, really well, I would say. It's a pity that more people haven't carried on. So you might have thought that two fleets, the old women's fleet and men's fleet, combining into one, you would have larger numbers. Well, that hasn't happened. People have either retired and moved on, or they've moved into other fleets like the 49er or the 49er FX, let's say. But I really like the way that it's working out for those that have stayed, and I hope that more are encouraged to get involved. Because, for example, at the World Championships in Israel, at the halfway stage of the competition after day three or day four, I did a count of the top 10, and there was an absolutely even split of five female helms and male crews, and the converse, the five male helms and five female crews. So in terms of having mixed gender competition that is perfectly fair, whichever way round you choose to sail the boat, it seems to be working extremely well, even if it ended up with three female helms and seven male helms at the end. The Worlds was still won by a female helm, Louise Wanzer, crewed by Philipp Altenreith from Germany, and they absolutely dominated the event, and they won before the medal race was sailed. And so I really like how that's working out so equally between the two ways of sailing the boat.
It's meant the retirement of quite a few big names from the class, though. I'm thinking of the Americans and the Australians are out now. Has that changed the kind of dynamic of the fleet?
Yeah, I think that now that Matt Belcher and Will Ryan, the gold medalists in the men, are out of the way, they set the standard for the last 10 years in the men's fleet, and it feels like it's wide open. And I had the Swedes pegged as the favourites. They had won the Europeans fairly convincingly, Anton Dahlberg and Lovisa Karlsson, and they won the pre-worlds in Israel. And then they just never showed up for the worlds themselves. And I don't know what happened to them, and I'm not sure they did either, but they finished about 12th or 13th. And then Jordi Jammer, the skipper of Sail GP, bronze medalist in the Olympics last year, second at the Europeans and second at the World Championships, crewed by Nora Brugman, formerly of USA, now sailing for Spain. And those two have probably been the most consistent this season. So they're also setting a pretty good benchmark. But I would say no one is really showing complete dominance right now. So that makes it very interesting.
Andy, I'm going to have to pause.
One of the things I really like about the 470, and I should state I've got a vested interest, apart from working for the class at the moment, I used to crew in the 470 back in the 90s, so I've got a soft spot for it. But it's the oldest piece of Olympic equipment, designed in 1962 or 3. But it's actually, in another definition of high performance, the most high performance of any of the Olympic events, including the 49er or the kite foiling that I've spoken about earlier. And that definition of high performance is able to go out and complete a race in the widest range of conditions. So from, say, 4 knots up to 40, you can pretty much have a race in a 470 and be pretty sure that you're going to complete that race fairly satisfactorily. And I think that this could well come to a head at the Sailing World Championships next year, which is the once every 4 years that all the Olympic classes have their single world championship in one place, which is going to be in The Hague on the North Sea, on the Dutch coast of the North Sea. And there's 2.5 knots of tide running there. I was there for the Youth Worlds earlier this year. And the only fleet in the 10 knots and less breeze that we had all week that completed their series were the 420s. The IQ foils and the Ilkas, well, the IQ foils needed minimum 9 knots of wind to get racing, and we hardly had that. So they only had 2 out of 6 days of racing. And the Ilka 6s, the old laser radial, as used to be called, couldn't make way against the current. So at the bottom end of the range, you've got that problem. At the upper end of the range, what if you've got 2.5 knots of tide against wind? You end up with these massive skyscraper waves. And the only boats that will reasonably comfortably deal with that are the Ilkas, which will be absolutely fine, and the 470. And then you'll have all the sexy classes pitch poling or crashing out, you know, the foilers and the so-called high performance classes really struggle to keep going in those conditions. So it will be interesting to see what The Hague yields next year at the World Championship. So I'd like to see another way of looking at high performance other than ultimate top speed.
Yeah, seems like the introduction of this kite foiling for the Olympics, they've kind of missed a trick, haven't they, if you can't sail them in low-end conditions? I thought that was a given now.
Well, kite foiling is pretty good as long as you've got 4 or 5 knots of wind. The problem below that is that the kites then flutter to the water, which is not good for the kites, and they need rescuing by coach boats and whatever else. So you tend to avoid having races in those kind of marginal conditions if you think that's what's going to happen. So kite foiling has definitely got its weak spot there, but at least once it's up and running, they're going at phenomenal speeds. The IQ foils are a bit more of a problem because their minimum wind speed that they need is about 9 knots. They do downwind slalom racing. So as long as they can sit down on the coach boat and get a lift to the top of the course, sort of get the ski lift back up to the top of the course again, then that's okay. But that didn't work at the Youth Worlds, for example, because coach boats are very limited there to try and keep a lid on costs. So that's not an issue that applies at senior Olympic level, except that it sort of does, because World Sailing is trying to limit the number of coach boats for environmental and sustainability reasons. So I do think that there needs to be another look at what we mean by high performance, because when you were looking at the Olympics, you were looking for a made-for-TV show. And the most important thing, more than anything else, is that when it's showtime, it's showtime. And that's what SailGP, Russell Coutts, has done so well. He made that promise very early on of from 3 to 30 knots. I think maybe that was the tagline for the America's Cup in Bermuda 2017. I don't think they use that tagline anymore, but now they've got the three rigs, the choice of the quiver of rigs, which is obviously not inexpensive. It's not exactly a cheap option, but it means that the show can go out. And for example, at that super windy day that we had a few weeks back, where I mean, some of the sailors, like when I was talking to Jordi Jamar about it, were saying, well, you wouldn't normally sail any kind of boat in that strength of breeze, and yet out they went in those crazy F50s.
Yeah, and that, I mean, you've given me a lovely segue into that. That was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. That event in Saint-Tropez, the opening day and all of that wind was just breathtaking to watch. I defy anybody, even the strongest critic of SailGP, not to be impressed by just how exciting that whole thing was. And you could see from the look on the helmsman's faces, they were clinging on to control of those boats. And, you know, just amazing skill. Super, super impressive. But, and I was talking to somebody about this today, the development that the organizers have been talking about, upgrading the rudders, upgrading the foils, it can't really come quickly enough, because those boats were beyond the limit on that point. I mean, it was almost unsailable for them. So if they want to be able to race in those conditions, then the upgrade that they're talking about happening this season really does need to happen, I think. But very cool that it's already on the books. It's already, you know, they're being built right now. I think the development has already taken place.
Well, Russell Coutts' focus is relentless, and that drive to deliver that made-for-TV product is making them ask some hard questions of themselves, rather than just say, well, you know, that's just yacht racing. Got to accept that we're going to have to delay the start by 2 or 3 hours or a day or whatever. You know, it's just not an option. And we got away with that with the skin of our teeth at Tokyo last year, because we had a no-win day. And we had no medal races. It was meant to be 2 medal races a day. And so those medal races got shoved to the next day, which was fortunate for us, because we had a 4 medal race day just on the day that the IOC president, Thomas Bach, rolled in to Enoshima to see how the sailing was going. And we put on 4 incredible medal races that day. But imagine if the president of the IOC had showed up a day earlier. And it had just been tumbleweed in the boat park, not going anywhere because there was no wind, just an AP flag hanging limply from a pole.
Exactly. Know? Yeah, exactly. So
we've got to address that is still the elephant in the room. And whatever we can do to make sure that the show goes out on time is what we need to do. And that's what SailGP is doing so well.
Yeah. Of course, there'll be a whole bunch of people listening to this that really don't care particularly about the Olympics. They just want to go sailing in their own boats, and they're quite right. They're absolutely right.
Absolutely. But, absolutely. But so the examples of the Barcelona and the, you know, the Boldor, there being absolutely no wind and whatever else, we as participating sailors, we accept that as part of the game, and that is sort of part of the fun of it, is, you know, but it's not exactly great TV. So there are two different things we're talking about there. I've got nothing against us drifting around in next to no wind, because that's still the fun of yacht racing.
Now, something we didn't talk about before the show, but I just want to run it past you, is the news that the America's Cup is going to have a behind the scenes, expose all, open door documentary. I think it's a series. I'm not sure. Actually, may need to check that, whether it's a film or it's a series.
I think it's a series, but
yeah,
yes. So my thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a little wary of the whole, oh, it's like Drive to Survive, because I hope it's not trying to be that, because that's a very specific, really well done product for a very specific sport. I think we can do something different that will be just as interesting and compelling to watch.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. I just think Drive to Survive is the benchmark that everyone is striving to emulate. But yes, if you can do it even better, then great. And I suppose if you could get even more access behind closed doors, access to those America's Cup teams than Drive to Survive gets in Formula One, then it could be even better. But what constantly amazes me is the access that Drive to Survive is allowed to get, which they didn't have much access to the top teams in season one, and that made them focus on Haas and the other teams at the back of the grid, which actually I think is often the more interesting story. But now that they've seen how hard the tail is wagging the rest of the dog, and just how much commercial value and extra viewers Drive to Survive has brought to Formula One, I think all of the teams are being forced to sit up and take notice, and they're being forced to open their doors perhaps more than they would like to have done, because at the end they realise that's what's making the money go round, and they're all ending up richer because of it. So that is the key, is how much fly on the wall, you know, get to see the nitty-gritty of those arguments. That's what will make or break the series. But I couldn't be more excited about that, because you look at what Drive to Survive has done for putting new life into Formula One, and there are many other examples of other sports now trying to do the same and have achieved the same. You know, with can't remember his name now, the basketball legend Michael Jordan,
yeah.
And his series. You know, if we can get that treatment, which we've seen to a degree with things like Chasing Tokyo, the British Olympic drive for the Tokyo Games, and there are other documentaries like the recent America's Cup one. But if we get the full, I'm going to say I don't mind being associated with Drive to Survive. If we get the Drive to Survive treatment with America's Cup, I'd be more than happy with that. It's the best thing that's ever happened to the sport.
And there's a lot of it about, as they say, because the ocean race is also got its own kind of deal going on with Discovery, the Discovery Channel. I think I've got that right. Yeah, the Discovery Channel.
You are right. Yeah, that's right.
And that in itself could be amazing as well. It's, you know, a lot of people are kind of cynical about the ocean race because it's kind of dropped off the map a little bit with COVID and, you know, low numbers of teams. But there are five top IMOCA teams going to be racing around the world, and involvement from some of the 65s as well. A race around the world is a great story. It always is. There's always, you know, great subplots that come out of it. I think that's going to be really interesting to see how they do that. And but for me, the really interesting thing about all of these is that it's because it's retrospective that it works so well. You know, you're not trying to update people on a monthly basis of, you know, this is what happened in the America's Cup this week. It's going to be let's look at what happened. Let's look at the footage we've got. Let's look at the interviews we've got, and then put something together which really tells the story well. And that's what Drive to Survive does supremely.
Yeah. So Drive to Survive doesn't live or die on whether you know the outcome of that particular race. It helps if you don't know, but it doesn't break the drama if you already knew what happened in the previous season. And so I think you're absolutely right. And I just hope that there is that same drive to with the Ocean Race version to be as frank and as honest as we've seen with some of these other documentaries. Because I just remember, Justin, it's probably about 10 years ago when you were working in-house for the Volvo Ocean Race, and you found this amazing bit of clip that someone had sent you off one of the boats, and it was some real hard-ass, I forget if it was a brooch or what it was, but you said, well, obviously we're going to put this up, and you were told, no, you can't put that up. That's,
yeah.
What was it? Just remind me what
it
was.
Yeah, there was, I actually forget what the incident was, but I do remember talking to you about it, and it was such a fantastic piece of sailing footage. I think it was a bad brooch, but yeah, the race then was owned by Volvo, and Volvo are a very safety conscious company. And I think that's where the issue was, but also the team involved, their sponsor was like, oh, we don't want to be seen to be risking people's lives. Yeah, it's a real fine balance. And I know that some of the teams who've been trying to raise money for this edition of the race, that's a common issue that comes up is, well, you know, people die on this race, and that's difficult for us as a company to associate ourselves with. And it's pretty black and white. You know, you either are willing to be associated with something that's high risk or you're not. But I think there's a few deals have gone down the Swanee because of that.
Yeah, which is fair enough. But, you know, the tagline of that race was life at the extreme. So it's crazy to me that you had to have that internal conversation about putting up one of the best pieces of content. So
that's right.
You know, I hope that the Ocean Race has got beyond having those basic kind of conversations, because that really should be a discussion.
Well, talking of drama on the open ocean, the one that stuck out for me today, yesterday, the Route de Rome is happening as we're recording this. In fact, Charles Caudrelier has just clinched the Ultim class this morning. But Fabrice Amedeo, French ex-journalist turned solo skipper, had an absolute, you can only describe it as a nightmare, and was very close to losing his life. His quote was, I guess he is a journalist, so he gave a great quote, which was, death did not claim me today.
Yeah.
But I don't want to kind of go too deep into it, but his boat basically caught fire. And he had seconds to escape, and then found himself ensnared. His life raft was still tied to the back of the boat. It was supposed to release and hadn't done. And he had like one go with the knife. Otherwise, he was going to get engulfed in flames too. I mean, it's a great story, but holy moly.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you wouldn't want health and safety casting their eye over the Route de Rome, would you? I mean, that race never fails to impress with these kind of stories. It happens every time.
Yeah.
And then a story of a boat running into a commercial ship as well. I mean, that's
being dismasted.
It's not a great look, is it?
No. Well, Andrew Irvine, who was a senior person at Rourke, his comment on social media that I saw was, that's why we don't encourage single-handed racing at Rourke, at the Royal Ocean Racing Club, because you can't keep a good enough lookout. And on that day, it's hard to argue with that, really. But I guess 100 and something boats, you know, are still going to make it across the ocean unscathed. But it's been high attrition this time. And just a word about Sam Goodchild, is a good friend of both of ours, who was injured. He's been on my podcast before. He was injured before the start on his multi 50 when his pedestal winch back wound and I think hit him in the face and also on the arms. So I mean, I can only imagine that must have been just hideous. So hoping Sam has a quick recovery, hoping he's okay and back to sailing again first. And he was one of the favourites in that class as well. So he will be gutted. I think he dismasted in the last race as well, so not the luckiest race for him, the Route de Rome.
Yeah, well, we wish him all the best. It did sound horrendous, and yeah, it's such a dangerous game, isn't it?
It is. Andy, we're approaching that time that we say we'll have the cutoff. Most people can only tolerate about this length of time listening to us witter on about what we think about sailing. Is there anything we've missed that we should have talked about? Anything burning from your side?
Oh, well, of course there will be. There have been many things that many other things that we should talk about, but it has been an amazing 2022. It does feel like life has got back to normal, and yeah, so just looking back in that rearview mirror, I'm very thankful for that. And well, it must be very exciting for you living in Parma, having Ben Ainslie and his America's Cup team showing up on your doorstep and using Parma as their training base. And so, you know, we're just under 2 years out from the next America's Cup. So that's quite exciting to see how that pans out. And let's hope the Ocean Race works out okay, because it is a bit down on numbers. But yeah, let's hope there's enough to make a decent race out of that.
Yeah, let's do that. And let's try and catch up in the new year once we find out a bit more about how the Brits are doing here in Mallorca. They haven't done a lot of sailing yet. In fact, they haven't done any. But that's coming soon. I'll tell you what they have been doing, which is really impressive, is the record-breaking runs their cyclos have been making up Sa Calabria, which is the big cyclist's hill. If you have a look at Strava, they're breaking all records up there. So that gives you some sort of clue to what's going on.
What, even against the pro cyclists?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
These guys are cycling at world-class ability.
As I understand it, yeah, they're breaking records. That's maybe over-egging it, but they're certainly turning in some impressive runs up that hill, which is... I struggle to drive my Fiat 500 up it, so how these guys are cycling up it, I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, Andy, let's close it down at that. Let's try and catch up in the new year and have a chat about the Ocean Race, the America's Cup, and SailGP. And until then, I'll just say thanks a million. It's been great catching up.
Yeah, Justin, it's been good. Yeah, let's do it again soon. Bye for now.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My thanks to Andy Rice for taking the time to chat with me, and thanks also to all of you for listening around the world. I'll be back soon with another great sailing guest, and until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.